Hello and welcome to the January 2012 IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast. My name is Michael Stewart and I'm the Director of Implementation Activities at the IASB. And with me today are Gary Berkowitz and Patrick LaFlau, who are two of the staff at the IASB working on Interpretations Committee work. Now, this podcast provides an informal staff summary of some of the issues that were discussed by the Interpretations Committee when it met on the 17th and 18th of January 2012, and as such are just our personal views and perspectives. The formal views of the committee and of the ISB are published in the IFRIC Update newsletter, and changes to IFRSs only happen after full due process and public consultation. So starting off with the issues that we looked at last week in the Interpretations Committee, Patrick, one of the things that we looked at and the committee looked at was to do with levies charged for participation in a market on a specific date. And it's certainly something that the committee has been looking at a few times already. What was new this time? What did they say this time?
Well, we should remind first that this topic is about levies charged by public authorities that are payable as a result of participating in a specific market in a particular period or on a particular date. It should be noted that in some cases the amount of the levy is driven by a measure such as revenue generated in a preceding period. The issue is about when to recognize the liability and what is the obligating event in accordance with IAS 37. It's also about whether the liability can be recognized progressively over the course of the year, many of these levies being annual levies. The issue was added to the agenda in July and discussed again this time. And the committee decided to develop an interpretation that addresses levies generally. So that's a big step.
Because we do already have an IFRIC interpretation, IFRIC 6, that does address certain levies, don't we?
Yes,
so
we have.
So how does that interrelate?
Well, that was not decided, but the idea would be either to include IFRIC 6 in the new interpretation that would be addressing levies generally, or we would maybe keep IFRIC 6 and address only levies in the new interpretation. There was a second big step made by the committee, because the committee also reached a conclusion on interim reporting and confirmed that the same principles should be applied in the interim financial statements as are applied in the annual financial statements. Lastly, one third topic that was discussed was with respect to levies that are due only if a minimum threshold is met, and the committee could not reach a consensus on this topic as to whether the threshold is a measurement criterion or a recognition criterion. So the committee decided to ask the board whether the guidance in IAS 34 and contingent lease payments would also apply in annual financial statements, and the committee will consider the board's feedback and will discuss again this issue, this specific issue about the thresholds, at the next meeting.
Okay, so the issue about thresholds isn't a dead one. It will come back to a future meeting.
It will come back.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. And turning to the next issue, Gary, we had a discussion at this meeting about equity accounting and accounting for changes in an associate that are outside of the associate's comprehensive income, in other words, sort of other equity changes. And where did the committee get to on this topic this time?
Yeah, I actually thought the committee made quite a lot of progress there, Michael. I think just to maybe take a step back and sum up what the committee was talking about, I think the equity method in IAS 28 is currently clear that an investor picks up its share of the associate's net income and its share of the associate's other comprehensive income. However, there's currently uncertainty with whether or not IAS 28 whether or not you should actually pick up changes in the net assets of the associate that are outside of comprehensive income, as you said, so what we call other equity changes. And the question there is, should those other changes in net assets of the associate be recognized by the investor in their profit and loss, in their OCI, in equity, or possibly not even at all?
And what sort of changes are we talking about here?
So this could be a situation where the associate issues shares to all of its investors other than the entity that we're worried about here. So in other words, you would have a dilution in the investors' accounts, but there would have been a change in the net assets of the associate. So in the associate, it would have recorded that change directly through equity. And the question is there in the investors' accounts, what do you do with that change in net assets?
Right.
So the question, should it go through, you know, P&L, OCI, equity, or not at all? Another simple example could be where the associate buys shares back from other shareholders other than the investor. That would be another example of where you'd have a change in net assets that would be recorded in equity of the associate. Like I said, I thought the committee made some really good progress in this meeting. The tentative conclusions that they reached were that when the investor's share of the associate decreases, either directly or indirectly, so in other words, if you go from 25% holding down to a 20% holding, if that happens directly because you go out and sell a 5% stake in your associate directly into the market, or, as we were explaining in the other example, indirectly, where the associate actually issues shares into the market, and because of that share issue, you are diluted down from 25 to 20. The committee said in either of those circumstances, that should be treated the same way, and that should be treated as a disposal through P&L. So in other words, that change, whatever that net asset changes, should be recorded through P&L and the investor.
And we're talking here about partial disposals where they still retain significant influence, is that right?
Yeah, that's a very good point, Michael, yeah. So we're talking about you have an associate before this transaction and you still have an associate after the transaction. So there's no change to control or down below significant influence. And similarly, the other very good principle or tentative conclusion that the committee reached was when the investor's share of the associate increases, and again, either directly or indirectly, that should be accounted for at cost, and there should be no recognition of P&L in the investor. So, and again, to the point you made before, we're talking about incremental acquisitions. So let's assume the investor already had 20% in the associate. The associate goes out into the market and has a share buyback, but it doesn't buy shares back from the investor. Because of that, the investor's effective shareholding in the associate is going to go up, let's say to 25%. And the conclusion the committee tentatively reached was that increase should be accounted for at cost. So there'll be no P&L impact to the investor when that type of transaction occurs. I'd like to say we closed that one out there, but I think there is still a bit more work to do there. And the committee asked us to go away and do a bit more thinking around equity-settled share-based payments of an associate. So either for employee services or for the acquisition of an asset by issuing shares in the associate. Because again, if you think of what we're saying, there's going to be a change in the associate's equity there and a change in the net assets, but that change in equity is the one half of the share-based payment goes directly through equity. So the question is, how does the investor account for that? And the second issue, which is a similar issue, is the committee asked us to go away and think about the accounting for written call options in the associate that are where the associate just gets cash. So it's not like a share-based payment, it's just a financing. So we'll be bringing that back to the committee at a future meeting. So watch this space, but hopefully we'll be able to close that one out pretty soon.
Good, thank you. Another issue that the committee looked at again this time, and it's had a go at this issue for a few times over a couple of years now, it seems like, and that's how to account for put options that are written over non-controlling interests, and so the accounting under R32, and how we should deal with the liability that is recognised there, or is changes in the liability that's recognised there when the exercise price is a variable exercise price. And Gary, where did the committee get to in terms of discussions this time around?
Yeah, again, I think the committee made quite a lot of progress. As you said, Michael, I think this issue's been banging around from before my time. But as you mentioned, this is the accounting for put options over non-controlling interests. So maybe just a simple example just to help the listeners think what we're talking about here. This would be, for example, where a parent owns 80% of a subsidiary and for whatever reason it's going to acquire the remaining 20%. And the way this is done is the subsidiary writes a put option to the current NCI holders, the remaining 20%. And if you remember very simply, a put option would give those holders the right, but not the obligation, to sell their remaining stake, their 20%, back to the subsidiary or to the parent at a point in time for either a fixed price or, as you mentioned, a variable price, which is where it really gets interesting, and I'll explain a bit more why now. So as we know, IAS 32 says that if you're going to actually gross physically settle and buy your shares back for an amount of cash, you need to record that liability when you enter into the contract. So on day one, you know, the subsidiary would record that liability that they have to possibly buy the shares back with the debit recorded in equity.
And that's the gross liability, isn't it? It's the amount of cash they could be required to pay.
Absolutely, which is what IAS 32 requires, as we said, when it's gross physically settled. So we're not talking about a derivative here. They're not trying to enter into any fancy derivative. They're really going to buy the shares back. They're going to physically take delivery of the shares and pay cash for those shares. And as you mentioned, the question really relates, it's not so much the initial day one recognition of that liability, it's the changes in the measurement of that liability. Because, for example, if you said to those, that NCI, you can sell the shares back to me, you know, in a 5-year period, and the price that I will pay when you sell those shares back is based on the fair value of the shares, which means that every reporting period, the value of that liability is actually changing. And the question that came in is, well, when the subsidiary remeasures it, or from a consolidated point of view, when the consolidated accounts are presented, the remeasurements in that liability, where should that be presented? Should that be presented through P&L, or should that be presented through equity? And the issue actually arises because of a perceived conflict that we have now in IAS 39 and IAS 27. If you think, IAS 39 is pretty clear, and it says changes in that liability need to go through P&L. And IAS 27 seems to say, well, this could be interpreted as a transaction between shareholders, a transaction between the shareholders and the non-controlling interests. And IAS 27 seems to indicate when you have a transaction like that, you don't get a gain or loss that goes through P&L. All those changes should go through equity. So on the one hand, we've got a standard that says P&L. On the other hand, we've got a standard that appears to say equity. And this is why this issue was brought to the committee. As I said, as you mentioned, this issue has been going on for quite a while now. And at this committee meeting, the discussion focused, and I thought, you know, the committee did a really good job here, the discussion focused on the wording in IAS 27, and specifically the words that say, sure, you have to record those transactions with your non-controlling interests or among shareholders through equity, but IAS 27 says the changes in the parent's ownership interest in the subsidiary that don't result in a loss of control go through equity. And the committee said, well, actually, if you think about it, that means that it's only when the rights associated with those shares actually transfer, because that will drive the change in ownership interests, and that's the piece of the transaction that is recorded directly through equity. And if you interpret IAS 27 in that way, the consequence, obviously, of that is to say that any remeasurements up to the date of the NCI actually exercising that put option are still within the scope of IAS 39, and therefore the consequence being that those changes in measurement would go through profit and loss.
Okay, so in circumstances where those rights don't transfer until the option is exercised, that would suggest that the IAS 27 guidance applies at the date of exercise and not prior to that date.
Absolutely, okay. Yeah, that's where the committee got on that. Now, like I say, you know, let's see if that is possibly the end of the story, because it has been going on for a long time. So the next steps is the committee is effectively going to take that to the board as their recommendation with this. And assuming that the board agrees with that, the committee is further recommending that the board then amend IAS 27 just to clarify that, because obviously there is some confusion in practice at the moment.
Okay, good. And Patrick, we had an issue that came to the committee for the first time this time about accretion of interest on long-term prepayments, for example, prepayments for purchasing inventories. What was the issue there?
Yes, Michael, the question here is whether a purchaser of raw materials should accrete interest on long-term prepayments by recognizing, for instance, an interest income resulting in an increase of the cost of inventories. We observed that there is currently mixed practice on this issue, especially in Europe. Some do accrete interest in on long-term prepayments, others do not accrete interest on long-term prepayments, and the committee members were also very mixed on this issue. They observed that current IFRSs do not provide clear guidance on this issue, although a slim majority of committee members seem to consider that there is implicit or explicit guidance that leads to reflect the time value of money in a transaction.
So that accretion of discount should be recorded?
Well, yes, that there should be accretion of interest because this is a basic principle of IFRSs to reflect time value of money. The committee also noted that there is currently a project on revenue recognition that also deals with this matter, and that the exposure draft specifically addressed this issue and says that the seller should separately account for time value of money. So there's no doubt that in the current exposure draft as it states now, a financing component that is included in a contract should be reflected in the financial statements.
And that covers both accelerated payments and credit payments as well.
Exactly. When payments are in advance or in arrears, you should reflect the time value of money.
And just a clarification for me, we're talking there, though, in the revenue recognition ED, though, from the seller's point of view.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah, the exposure draft deals with the seller's on the seller's accounting, whereas here we are dealing with the purchaser's accounting. Mm-hmm. So I think the committee plans to address this issue in coordination with the board and with the revenue project, and the plan here is to identify what standards would need to be amended should the board decide to align the seller's accounting and the purchaser's accounting. And assuming, of course, that the revenue proposals in the exposure draft are finalized.
Yes. Okay. So will this be coming back to the committee then?
Yeah, this will come back to the committee, to the next meeting.
And then another issue that, or set of issues that the committee looked at this time was relating to annual improvements. Now, of course, the Interpretations Committee has took on a role related to annual improvements a couple of years ago now, whereby it's helping out the board by looking at proposals for annual improvements, but also looking at the comment letters received in response to the exposure draft. And there was an exposure draft published last June, and comments received that were brought to the committee at this January meeting. And six of the proposed annual improvements, the comments on those were discussed this time. And the committee confirmed their agreement that all six of those should, albeit with modifications, be recommended to the board for finalisation. One to mention, I think, perhaps, is one related to IAS 1 and to do with the presentation of comparatives in financial statements. And there were a couple of issues here that the board had been intending to clarify with this proposed amendment. And one was that when an opening balance sheet is required to be given because of a change in accounting policy or restatement that affects the balance sheet, that detailed notes are not required for those that opening balance sheet, but just sufficient information to enable a reader of the financial statements to understand what the changes have been and how they've affected the opening balance sheet. There was also, as a response to comments received on the exposure draft, a proposal which the committee has agreed to recommend that the board make, that opening balance sheet isn't required when the change in policy or the restatement doesn't actually affect the opening balance sheet. So the proposal there is that the company would still be able to just give the usual two balance sheets. The other issue that was addressed by this proposed amendment to IS1 relates to when additional information, additional primary statements, so for example an income statement or a balance sheet or a statement of change in equity, when that's given voluntarily, that if you give one of those statements voluntarily, you don't need to give the other statements. So it's not a full set of financials that's needed. But if a single statement is given, for example, a balance sheet at a third date, then all of the notes associated with that particular primary statement do need to be given if the reason for giving that additional balance sheet is because it's being given for voluntary reasons. And those voluntary reasons would be things other than a requirement by IFRS's. So something that was purely voluntary on behalf of the company, or perhaps a requirement of regulations but not a requirement of IFRS's, the full detailed notes would need to be given for that particular statement. Anyway, those six issues will be going to the board with the committee's recommendations, probably in the March board meeting, and the board will then be asked if they agree with those proposed amendments and whether they want to finalise those changes to IFRS's. The other thing to mention that was talked about briefly at the Interpretations Committee was some additional issues that have been advised, that have been submitted for consideration by the committee, that will be brought along to the next Interpretations Committee meeting. Those two issues, one related to rate-regulated activities, and a question about whether a customer base within a single regulatory environment could be viewed as a single unit of account, and if it is possible to view that customer base as a single unit of account, whether that would lead to the recognition of regulatory assets and liabilities. The second issue relates to land use rights and how to account for those. Now, those land use rights might be rights to cultivate the land or rights to build on the land, and the question there is whether those rights, how should they be accounted for? Should they be recognised as assets? And if so, are they property, plant and equipment or intangibles, or maybe it's a lease type of asset? So those are two issues that we'll be bringing to the committee at the March Interpretations Committee meeting. Well, the full report of the proceedings of the Interpretations Committee will be published in the IFRIC Update newsletter on the ISB website in the next few days, and that will provide the formal report of that meeting. And the next meeting of the Interpretations Committee will be on the 13th and 14th of March 2012. So what you've heard today has been just some personal perspectives from the staff of the matters discussed at the Interpretations Committee, and I would just like to remind you that views that you've heard today are not the formal views of the ISB or the Interpretations Committee, and that changes to IFRS's only take place as a result of full due process, including public consultation, and those matters being reported through the issue of an IFRS or an IFRIC interpretation. Thank you for listening.